All right, well, we're going to jump in here this morning. Our time's a little bit shorter, so our text is going to be in 1 Corinthians chapter 4. And again, we're going to be taking a little bit of time, just periodically over the next few months, to look at this theme of stewardship. And so today's kind of the first in that installment, and we're going to look here in 1 Corinthians 4. We tend to be, as a culture, enamored with celebrities. We have these ideas of what success really looks like, and it usually has something to do with money, fame, unique, extraordinary, eye-catching types of abilities, beauty. And unfortunately, this way of thinking has even infiltrated the church. Sometimes we get caught up in this, right? In terms of thinking and evaluating ourselves and other people on some pretty twisted criteria. I love this quote by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer was a German pastor around the time of Hitler's occupation in Germany. Bonhoeffer would eventually have to sort of stop his public preaching ministry, and he would go underground, and he lived training pastors for an extended period of time, and he learned some things about living together as brothers and sisters in Christ, right? About how churches operate, both good and bad. And this statement was so powerful, he wrote about it in his book, Life Together. He said, "There arose a reasoning among them, which of them should be the greatest," right? There was that account out of the Gospels, Luke chapter 9. "There arose a reasoning among them, which of them should be the greatest." We know who it is that sows this thought in the Christian community. But perhaps we do not bear in mind enough that no Christian community ever comes together without this thought immediately emerging as a seed of discord. Thus, at the very beginning of Christian fellowship, there is engendered an invisible, often unconscious, life and death contest. Hence, it is vitally necessary that every Christian community, from the very outset, face this dangerous enemy squarely and eradicate it. There is no time to lose here, for from the first moment when a man meets another person, he is looking for a strategic position he can assume and hold over against that person. Now, we don't think about it in quite such blatant terms, right? But the point is that we have a nasty habit of comparing ourselves to one another. And we're looking for an advantage that I might have over that other person. And the end result of this is usually that either we come away with an overinflated sense of ourselves, or we come away feeling really crummy, right? Because either we can find somebody to point to that's below us in our estimation, or we feel like everybody else is succeeding and we are not. In any regard, it's a really bad pattern. We would expect it of a secular culture to think in those terms, but the church ought to think differently. Here in 1 Corinthians, we encounter a church that was racked by division. Matter of fact, in chapter 3, there's these little pockets of political groupings. There was Paul, the Apostle Paul, and the Apostle Peter, and Apollos, who was a very gifted teacher in the early church. And people were aligned around these individual super apostles. And Paul kind of steps into that situation, writes to them, and says, "Hey, we need a new paradigm here, right? This is really broken. This is not a good thing." And I think what Paul really does is help us to think about what is true success, and how do you pursue true success? How should we think about ourselves? We shouldn't think in terms of comparison. How do we think about, or how should we think about ourselves? So we're going to look at, I think, three lessons that emerge here from this text that help us pursue true success. All right, let's get aligned here this morning. So let's look at this text and read it together. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 1. Hear the word of the Lord. This is how one should regard us as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it is required of stewards that they be found faithful. But with me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself, for I am not aware of anything against myself, but I am not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges me. Therefore, do not pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the things now hidden in darkness and will disclose the purposes of the heart. Then each one will receive his commendation from God. May God add his blessing to the reading of his word. Number one, we must think about ourselves in the right way. This is where Paul begins by creating a couple of mental images. This is the broken way of comparing yourself and pursuing alignment with these various political factions and these seemingly important figures. Let me give you a new way to think, a new paradigm. It gives them two images. First, we are servants. We are servants. Now, Paul uses this kind of language a lot to describe himself. He uses this kind of language to describe believers in the church. But this is not his normal word. We use the same English word to capture it here, but it's not the normal word that Paul uses. Usually he uses a word that basically means slave. But here he uses a word that would literally be translated as under rower. So in the ancient world, a sailing vessel would not have an engine, of course, and on the lowest level, down below the deck, would be benches and perhaps 100 or more individuals down there working the oars, right? Powering the ship. It's the lowest class on the ship. These common laborers down there in the galley. And Paul says, that's us. We are subordinates. We have low rank. Now, it's not a demeaning thought, but certainly one that describes subordination. It's low. Right? We're told that Paul and Barnabas went on a missionary journey. And we're told that they had a young teenager named John Mark who was with them. And the text says in Acts 13 that he went with them as their assistant. It's the same word. John Mark was their under rower. He was the gopher. He was the one that was being sent to get the group together for the next teaching session, right? He was being sent out to get lunch. He was kind of low. He wasn't exactly an apostle, right? But he was doing important work for Paul and Barnabas. And Paul says here at this point, that's us. That's a good way to think about us. We are under rowers. And of course, he gives the great designation there that not only are they servants or under rowers, but they are servants of Christ. So we might have a menial task, but we have a great boss. Right? There's a new Chick-fil-A going in. How many of you know this? Yeah, you've been paying attention. There's a new Chick-fil-A going in. People like to eat at Chick-fil-A. And from what I hear, people like to work at Chick-fil-A. That to maybe just be a cashier at Chick-fil-A would be a much better job than a manager at some other unnamed restaurant. Right? Because there's just a certain culture about Chick-fil-A. They give Sundays off. They're concerned about the well-being of their employees as well as their customers. And there's just a good culture there. So I can't help but think of that when he talks about being servants of Christ. Yes, it's low in one sense to be down below with the oars, but I'm piloting or I'm rowing for the greatest ship captain that has ever sailed the seas, right? That's something that ought to inspire. David said that I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God, right, King David? Rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to live in the tents of the wicked, than to live it up big and be wealthy. I'd rather be a nobody in God's kingdom. And so Paul has that mentality. We have a lowly position, but we have a great boss, a great master. So that's one of the images he wants them to have. And there's a second one. We're managers. Now, the ESV says, regard us as servants of Christ and stewards. I don't think the word steward is very helpful, to be honest. There's only one main context I think about stewards, right? That's on an airplane. The person who refills your drink and brings you peanuts, right? That's a steward in our culture. It's just not a word that's used very, very often. So we don't have a good framework for it. I think manager is probably a better word. House manager is the word here. And in the ancient world, you would likely have servants that worked for you, and you would have a chief servant, one who was in charge. If you were gone and out on business, which you would be often, that individual was taking care of everything in your absence. And so this is the idea. We are managers. It again has a sense of subordination to it. We've been entrusted with the mysteries of God. That's code language for the gospel. We've been entrusted. We've been made managers over these important things related to the gospel. And a manager not only is responsible to sort of preserve things, so we've been made managers of the gospel, the mysteries of God. That doesn't mean we just sort of sit on it and guard it. That's part of it. We guard the gospel from distortion, right? But being a manager means that I allocate funds. We have a trust. We have some special needs dynamics in our family. We have a trust. And we have trustees or executors who, if something were to happen to Sherry and I, those executors would take over. And they would not just guard our vast fortune, insert laughter now, right? They would not just guard over that. They would do this, right? They would allocate those funds in accordance with our wishes for the care of our children. That's the nature of a manager. I've been really challenged by this quote from Oswald Chambers on stewardship. He says, money is one of the touchstones in our Lord's teaching. Nowadays, we are taken up with our ideas of economy and thrift and never see that those ideas are not God's ideas. So we tend to think of stewardship. A good steward is someone who saves a lot and spends a little. If you coupon, you are a good steward. Now, maybe you are. But my point is that stewardship is more than just not spending. A faithful steward, a faithful manager, is one who uses the assets for the purposes that the master intends. Right? So it's not a good scenario in the account where the guy takes the talent, remember, and buries it in the ground. I mean, it's preserved, intact, and it's presented to the master when the master comes back. That's a failure. The point is that the master has this vast farm, this vast estate, and he wants the money put to use in his kingdom. If you sit on it, you fail. So we need to be challenged in this idea of what stewardship really is and how we think about our role. We're servants of the Lord, of Christ, and we are managers of the mysteries of God. We need to have our minds shaped in that way. Some Olympic watchers here have been watching Olympics, opening ceremonies. A few, okay. They made an interesting comment in the opening ceremonies about Korea and Korean culture. I don't know if anybody else caught it. They talked about how Korea wants to emphasize the identity and the importance of the group. And they used as one example the way that Koreans give their name, that they would put the last name, the family name, would go first, and then the personal name, because the family is more important than the individual. Now, each individual still has their own name. It's not to say they're stripped of any individual identity, but their name is of secondary importance. That's pretty powerful. I couldn't help but think about that. And I think Paul's saying something like that here, that when you think about ourselves, don't think of Paul and Peter and Apollos and John MacArthur and John Piper and Andy Stanley, right? But think of Christ and his kingdom. And we are workers in his kingdom. The last name comes first, right? So we think about this, we realize that money that we have in our bank accounts is ultimately not ours. The car in your driveway, the house that you live in is ultimately not yours. You are a servant, you are a manager. Those things have been entrusted into your care to allocate according to the wishes of the master. So we need to have our minds shaped by these kinds of thoughts. We need to think about ourselves in the right way. Number two, we must identify the right metric for measuring success. And I want to pause here and just read verses 2 through 4 from DeJesus' book. We do this periodically. It's a lot of fun. But it really captures this well. All right? Verses 2 through 4. The guy that go and take care of his boss's stuffs, he got to be the kind of guy that go and do what he's supposed to. No bother me what you guys think about the stuff I doing. Or what other people think. I no even act like one judge for my own self. My heart tell me I okay. But that no mean I okay. The boss, he the judge for what I do. Right? I mean, that, if you don't get that, then you're not listening, right? I mean, that just says it really well. Peer evaluation is of little importance. I don't care what you think. Paul doesn't actually say it quite that strongly. He says it's of little importance. This isn't Paul being brash and saying, I don't give a rip what you think. Now, this isn't Paul like, I'm unwilling to be accountable. This isn't just bravado. He's just saying human criticism is of little importance in the big picture, right? And again, in case we think he's just being arrogant, look what he says next. Self-evaluation is unreliable. I don't even care what I think about myself. I think I'm okay, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm okay. I think Paul's making a reference here to the conscience. Right? We've been hardwired with a conscience, a general sense of right and wrong, but that conscience is fallible. A conscience has to be properly informed and trained and maintained. You can develop a seared conscience to where the conscience doesn't work anymore. And there are people who have a peace about things that they shouldn't have a peace about. And that's what Paul's getting at here. At the end of the day, I can't even trust my own self-assessment. It is unreliable. At the end of the day, owner evaluation is what really counts. As he just drives at the issue here. You notice how he says it there in verse 2, moreover, it is required of stewards that they should be found faithful. What is the requirement? What is the metric? It is faithfulness, fidelity to the instructions of the master. That is what counts. And we need to identify the right metric for for measuring success. Number three, we must resist the urge to rank success based on uninformed and premature conclusions. We must think about ourselves in the right way. We must identify the right metric for measuring success. And we must resist the urge to rank success based on uninformed and premature conclusions. So he says there in verse 5, what he really focuses on as the takeaway, right? Therefore, do not pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes. The Master is returning. Don't arrive at final conclusions until the Master comes. Let's not post the grades until the professor shows up. All right? Let's not get ahead of ourselves here. Now, it's very interesting. We won't get into it this morning, but if we were to look ahead just one chapter, Paul says that we in the church are to judge one another. 1 Corinthians 5:12 and 13. He says, don't judge the world. Hey, don't try to police what's going on in the culture, all right? I'll take care of that. But you have a responsibility within the church to evaluate and to critique and to challenge and to confront one another. So it's interesting, isn't it? Here he says you're not to pronounce judgment. And just one chapter later, he's going to say you have a responsibility to judge one another. How do we understand the apparent conflict here? First of all, I think here in this text, in 1 Corinthians 4, 5, he's talking about final judgment. In other words, don't close the book on evaluation until Christ comes back. So I think he has in view sort of the final statement which will be issued upon the return of Christ, the Master. I think also here in this portion, he's talking specifically about praise. He's not just talking about judgment of sin and righteousness. He's talking specifically about the evaluation of our good deeds and our service for the Lord. And he's saying, essentially, you're not aware of all the details yet, right? Just like a parent, any human is going to not always have the full picture. A teacher might not have the full picture of the work that you've put in, right? A referee, I've been told sometimes that a referee might get it wrong. It's a rumor I heard one time. Actually, I run the clock at Forest Hill Central, and I hear that all the time. So yes, humans don't always see everything. But the Master, when he returns, will reveal all that was previously unknown, including the motivations of the heart and the things that were hidden from sight that no one else saw. The Master will be able to bring all of that to light and will reward each one accordingly. So this great picture. We want to make final judgments about people and who is successful and who is not. Hold it. All the information hasn't been gathered yet. There's so much we don't understand, but it will be brought to light. And that's meant to encourage us. I couldn't help but think of the widow's mite. You remember that account in the Gospels? Poor woman coming to bring her offering. She drops a penny into the collection box. And all these wealthy religious leaders had been coming and making large contributions. And remember what Jesus says? This woman's gift is greater than all the others. He shines the spotlight, right, onto it, exposing what's really going on there. This woman gave all that she had. And in God's estimation, when you consider the motivations of the heart and the things that no one else knew about, this woman was to be commended for her gift. And Paul wants to remind them of that there's a future evaluation coming in which all will be fully known. Beware of reaching conclusions about success or failure until the professor weighs in. So as we think about the opportunities that lie ahead of us as a congregation, I mean, Paul's words here are so fitting and so challenging. We must think about ourselves in the right way. Think about ourselves as servants, under rowers, and managers. We are not autonomous people who are able to do whatever we want with the things in our possession. We recognize that we've been entrusted by God with whatever we possess. And we have a master. We must identify the right metric for success. Faithfulness to the cause of Christ. Might use my money well from a world's perspective, right? But am I using and allocating my resources for the purposes that the master intends? That's the issue, right? And we must resist the urge to rank success based on uninformed and premature conclusions. We must always live with the awareness and the hope of Christ's return and the understanding that only then will all of the evaluations be in.